Hi, I'm Michelle Macklin, and you are listening to Crossword, where cultural clues lead to the truth of the word. This is my third season of recording. I took a year off to be an executive producer for a radio show and decided that I missed my authors, I missed my audience, and I missed discussing great books. If you have any suggestions for a book that where you would like to speak with the author, like me to speak with the author, please don't hesitate to contact me. Or if you're an author yourself and you would like to be interviewed, I am more than happy to interview you. I tend to focus on history, biographies, books of faith, books of reason, philosophy. So if you're an author of any of these tomes of work, please contact me. And thank you. Thanks for being my audience for a number of years now. I appreciate it. And if you like this recording, please subscribe and rate me. Thank you. God bless. I'd like to welcome Professor David A. Bell, a historian of the early modern Atlantic world, with a particular interest in the political culture of Enlightenment and revolutionary France. He is currently the Sidney and Ruth Lapidus Professor in the era of North Atlantic revolutions, and he is a professor of history at Princeton University, coming from us today from New York City, and a man who has just seen Ridley Scott's Napoleon. So welcome, Professor Bell. It's a real honor to have you here.
Well, thank you very much, Michelle. It's great to be here.
Okay, you know what? Let's get it out of the way first. This is one of the most anticipated movies of the year, I believe, because it's Ridley Scott, but also it is Napoleon. It is Napoleon Bonaparte that has captured our imagination for over 200 years. So let's get it out there, right out there. What did you think of the movie?
To be honest, mixed. I like Ridley Scott a lot. I love Gladiator. It is, you know, he's an incredibly entertaining filmmaker for the most part. I thought this movie, I mean, he's trying to compress a lot. I mean, he himself said that he wants to have to show a 4-hour director's cut, but to squeeze all of Napoleon's life, I mean, so many things into just 2 hours and 38 minutes, you know, it doesn't really work as well as it might. He skipped over a lot. He compressed a lot. He also spent a lot of time on the love, you know, the love story between Napoleon and Josephine, which, you know, is a great story, but it didn't really work. The chemistry wasn't there with the actors. That was a problem. And then I don't want to be pedantic about the history. I mean, you know, obviously people take artistic license, but in one sense, it's a pity because most of, you know, what people will learn about Napoleon Bonaparte, they'll learn from this film. And it's just, you know, it's just a travesty when it comes to the actual history. I mean, the number of errors just was unbelievable.
Oh, no.
It's fine. I mean, Gladiator wasn't true to the Roman history, but, you know, still, I mean, but this is a much more familiar piece of history. And there were lots of things that it wouldn't really have been that hard to get right. And it didn't really matter to the way he told the story. And he obviously just didn't really care. I mean, you know, he said when people criticized errors that they saw in the trailer, his response was, get a life.
Probably a good morality of the story, that true education really comes from reading books and studying and talking to people, and maybe not so much from Hollywood. What do you think? So entertainment's entertainment.
I wish that were the case. I think it's absolutely right. But I think a lot of people these days get their information from video of one form or another, from YouTube, from TikTok, from Facebook. You know, it does put a little more obligation on the filmmakers to try to at least get some things basically right. Maybe. I don't know.
Yikes. Let's start with Napoleon Bonaparte. And this is a man whose trajectory is really like no other. And he did this very young. He was, what, I think he was dead at 51, right?
He was.
And that was after 6 years of exile. So really everything he did was basically under the age of about 45. And that is incredibly young by our standards, and I think probably even by the standards of the day, where he had Talleyrand and he had a lot of older people around him. Let's start with the beginning of him. How does a Corsican minor noble rise to the level of emperor. And I always like to look in people's backgrounds. In your study, what have you found? What were some of the seeds that you think propelled this man to these dizzying heights?
Well, I would say actually the single most important thing was actually nothing to do with him particularly. It was two words, the French Revolution. I mean, so Napoleon, when he first, he's born in Corsica. He's born to a well-known family in Corsica in 1769. He is sent off to military school in France when he's very young by his father. He trains for the French army. And until 1789, so until he's 20 years old, what kind of future could he have been looking forward to, no matter how brilliant, no matter how determined, no matter how ambitious? Well, he would have been looking towards the future basically as probably a captain in the French army. That was about as high as he could have hoped to have risen, had it not been for the French Revolution. Because at the time, the French army was a very hierarchical place. The highest ranks were reserved for people from much higher social background than his. And no matter how good he was, he probably would never have been noticed and would have lived out his life as relatively low-ranking officer in the French army. And then the French Revolution happened. And suddenly, liberty, equality, fraternity, but particularly for him, equality. Suddenly, the social barriers to advancement were gone. And not only that, but a huge number of the officers in the army who had been there before the revolution actually left or were killed. A lot of them were against the revolution, and so they simply resigned from the army and often went abroad. A lot more of them were killed in the revolution itself. So this created lots of opportunities for people. And then particularly for a young, incredibly brilliant, incredibly ambitious young person like Napoleon, there was the chance to rise up. So I think that's the first context to put him in, that the French Revolution made this possible for him. But of course, it just made it possible. It opened the door in a sense. He still had to walk through it. You know, it's also interesting when you look back at Napoleon as a very young man. He was already very ambitious, but he himself knew that before the revolution, that there wasn't going to be a chance for him to really advance very much. So he wasn't actually thinking entirely of a career as a soldier. For a while, he thought about a career as a writer. He thought that he could become a great writer. So he wrote stories, he wrote essays, corresponded with famous authors from the period. And he also thought, you know, if he was going to have a military career, maybe it wouldn't be in France. Maybe he would go abroad somewhere. There was a period during the revolution when he actually thought very seriously of going to fight for the Turkish army and to be a soldier in the Turkish army where there might be more opportunity to rise up. But then again, the revolution happened. And he was also, I mean, another factor which I think is quite important is simply luck in a number of ways. So one thing to always remember about Napoleon is he is Corsican, right? And when he was growing up, he really believed in Corsican independence. Corsica had been an independent country until just the year before he was born, when France took it over. And a lot of Corsicans really hated that. They wanted to be independent again. And Napoleon, growing up, worshipped a man named Pasquale Paoli, who had been the leader of independent Corsica before the French took it over. And he really, you know, and so he dreamed of actually possibly, if he was going to be a soldier, another dream of his was to go back to Corsica and fight for its independence against France, against the country. So very ironic. And then he goes back, and then in the French Revolution, he actually goes back to Corsica. He goes back on leave from the army and he gets involved in the politics there. And for quite a while, and actually Paoli, who had been the leader of independent Corsica, comes back. And there's very complicated maneuvering in Corsican politics in the years 1789, 91, 92. And what happens in the end is that Napoleon and his brothers find themselves on the other side of the political divide from Paoli. There's a big conflict. And basically in the spring of 1793, Paoli wins and continues the movement for independence. So actually Paoli turns the island over to the British, who take it over. But Napoleon, by this point, has actually fled back to the mainland. He has gone back to mainland France with all his family. And that is, again, I mean, it was seen at the time by him and his family as a disaster. They were driven out of their homeland. They had to go back to France. But it turned out to be this incredible break, because soon afterwards, he was assigned to go to Toulon to help relieve the siege of Toulon. And there, not only did he have these brilliant ideas and these important strategic ideas to help relieve the siege of Toulon, or rather to not to relieve the siege, sorry, but to actually besiege Toulon, which had been taken over by the British. So not only did he do that, but he also caught the eye of a very important person who was the brother of Maximilien Robespierre. Maximilien Robespierre was the most important person in the French Revolutionary government at the time. His brother was in the South. His brother actually saw what Napoleon was capable of and wrote back to Paris, and he said, "I need to commend to you Napoleon Bonaparte, an officer of transcendent merit." So this caught the eye of people in Paris. Because of what happened at Toulon, Napoleon was promoted to brigadier general, and that was really the beginning of his career.
It's one thing that is, I think, really remarkable throughout his life, and there's a lot of caricature about Napoleon, so you have to read through a lot to, I think, kind of discern the truth in through different sources. But the man was brilliant. He was absolutely stunningly brilliant, and his energy level was far beyond anybody around him. And those things show up, I think, at a very early age, and he kind of expands upon those as he gets older. There's just some of the detail that he was capable of comprehending, of looking after, even when he was running an empire. So, when you look at kind of successful models of people, it's this prodigious memory, this quick intellect, and this high level of energy. And you really see that in Napoleon throughout his life. He runs circles around everybody around him.
For a long time, he does, absolutely. That's actually one of the things I didn't like so much in the film, is the film basically portrays him as this kind of lovesick puppy who is always sort of dashing after Josephine and doesn't really care about anything other than that. And, you know, not only was he brilliant, he's an incredibly hard worker. He'd work all the way through the night. And, you know, if you really wanted to sort of, you know, have a film that would be accurate about Napoleon, most of the time he would be at his damn desk, right? He would be reading reports, you know, meeting with people, analyzing stuff, writing correspondence, dictating correspondence. I mean, that's what you do. I mean, you know, the movie has him right there on the battlefield, which he was, absolutely, but it also has him, like, you know, in a cavalry, you know, riding a horse in a cavalry charge at the Battle of Waterloo, which is ridiculous, as if the emperor and general in command of the French army would do that. He's most of the time, he's actually reading stuff and writing stuff and analyzing stuff, because that's what you do in a position like that. And you're absolutely right. He did have this incredible sheer, you know, intelligence. Absolutely.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I've been very fortunate to know a number of our four stars in the U.S. Army. And I can correlate some of the successful models of what made Napoleon a success and what makes our four star generals a success. Mm-hmm. And not all of them, but a lot of them are brilliant, energetic, mm-hmm. run circles around everybody else. And we, the United States has been blessed with some brilliant generals. And we have some today.
Oh, absolutely.
One of the things that you said, you remarked upon, is luck. Mm-hmm. And tell me about how this guy kind of stayed one step ahead of the guillotine, because he was associated with Robespierre. I think it was even in Toulon that he was jailed for mm-hmm. a short period of time. How did he stay out of that? I mean, I think because he wasn't in Paris was actually helped him, but how did he stay away from the guillotine? How did he stay away from the ravages of the revolution?
Well, I mean, he probably wasn't in danger of the guillotine because he was associated. I mean, if he had been against Robespierre, he would have been in much greater danger of the guillotine.
Okay.
But when Robespierre fell, you know, the terror, you know, came to an end pretty soon after that. And while a lot of allies of Robespierre or people associated with Robespierre were jailed, there were only the very close associates were killed. So he wasn't by no means a close associate. Nobody had heard of him in the summer of 1794. But another thing about luck, which I think is just important to remember about Napoleon, he was somebody with, you know, in addition to having the brilliance, he was somebody with genuine physical courage, and he was really in the thick of the battles quite a lot. And there are so many occasions when he was almost killed. I mean, at Toulon, he was wounded. At many, many other battles, he came very close to death. There was a very serious assassination attempt on him in 1800, and when he was driving to the opera in a carriage, and terrorists essentially blew up a cart filled with gunpowder. I mean, we could call it a cart bomb, so to speak. And, I think they're probably, traveling on the Mediterranean when the Mediterranean was largely controlled by the British. You know, there were so many occasions when he could have easily have bought it. You know, there's certainly a great deal of luck in his career. There's the English historian Trevelyan who once wrote, he said, I can quote this pretty much exactly. He said, "I have in front of me a newspaper from 1799 reporting that Napoleon Bonaparte was killed, in the Mediterranean. I cannot tell you how much I wish this had been true."
Oh, geez, I bet. Well, let's talk about his lifelong obsession, hatred, fascination with Great Britain, with the United Kingdom. That started from a very early age, it seems like. What was that fascination? I mean, and Wellington had a fascination with Napoleon, too. Wellington said Napoleon was his equal. You know, what was this?
Britain and France were old enemies going back to the Hundred Years' War or beyond. In war after war, in the 17th and 18th century, while there were the occasional moments of alliance, mostly Britain and France were on the other side. And France continued to lose, lost the War of the Austrian Succession between 1740 and 48. And then, it lost the Seven Years' War between 1756 and 1763. And that was a real disaster. I mean, it lost it lost much of its empire. It lost, all of its possessions in North America, Louisiana, and Canada. I mean, about close to half the North American continent it had a claim on, and it lost that. It lost its possessions in India. It was humiliated on the battlefield in Germany, there by the Prussians more than by the British. So Britain was always the enemy. And then France and Britain went to war in 1793. And if you look at the whole scope of the Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars, which began in 1792 and lasted till 1815, Britain was at war with France almost continuously from 1793 to 1815, with only the brief Peace of Amiens in 1802, 1803. And Britain was the one country that he just could not beat. He wanted to invade them, but he had a problem, which was called the English Channel. He needed to be able to bring a flotilla across the English Channel. For that, he needed to protect the flotilla. For that, he needed a navy. And his navy simply could not stand against the British Navy. The British Navy was just too good. Beyond that, Britain had another thing, which people tend to forget often when they're simply reading the accounts of the battles, but which is obviously always so important for warfare, which is that Britain had the money. And not only were they able to finance their own navy, but Britain kept financing all the powers that were fighting against Napoleon throughout his wars. So they were helping to finance, powers in Germany. They basically took over Portugal and ran it as a puppet state. They financed the opposition in Spain. So Napoleon would have been able to win his wars, even on the continent, much more easily had it not been for all the British gold, basically, that was funding his enemies. Kept hoping that he could reestablish something of an overseas empire. He was not able to, thanks to Britain. So he hated the British. And he felt also that the British were fighting against him using completely uncivilized tactics, particularly blockading the continent against French trade and trying to destroy French trade. So what he tried to do was, in response, was actually to close off all of the continent to British trade, to try to deprive them of their export markets. And, and so that was what he called the continental system. And that not only did that not work very well, but it also forced him to try to go into large portions of the continent to control countries like Spain and Portugal that were really almost beyond the grasp, even beyond his grasp, to really keep control over these countries. And it also was one of the major factors behind his invasion of Russia. It was actually the battle with Britain that forced him to try to expand on the continent. And that was one of the things that ultimately led him to disaster.
It's almost as raison de guerre is Spain, Portugal, Egypt, I think you can argue too, and most certainly Russia was to try to circumvent, to try to cut off the British. Really interesting. And he never succeeds, which I was reading the French newspapers when King Charles was recently visiting Paris. Old Napoleon was rolling around in his grave in Les Invalides because they were saying Vive le Roi. which I find very, very ironic. But let's talk about propaganda. He understood social media before social media was cool. And that's in the papers. Am I right? I mean, every war he went to, he was able to turn it around to a resounding success until it was an absolute resounding failure. But he was, I mean, even Wagram, with every war, he was the successor. He was a media mogul before it was even cool to say those words.
Absolutely. I mean, the way I put it in my short biography of Napoleon, as I said, you know, he was just as good at sort of publicizing his battles as he was at winning them. He understood absolutely the importance of both written and visual propaganda. So when, from the very beginning, when he goes to the Army of Italy, when he commands the Army of Italy and invades, you know, northern Italy in 1796, he actually founds two newspapers, which are, you know, one of which is simply really for the army in Italy itself. And the other one, but the soldiers are also very important. I mean, he understands how important it is even to have propaganda among your own soldiers. And then the other newspaper was to report on his victories back in France. And he also made sure that the military bulletins he sent would be fully distributed and reprinted and put into the newspapers in France. And then also worked very hard to make sure that images of him and of his great victories were printed, you know, in the form of engravings and were distributed very widely. He even encouraged people to write plays about him. There were even while he was still a general, there were probably a dozen plays written about Napoleon already that were performed on the stage in various parts of France. So yeah, he was an absolute genius at propaganda, and he also knew the great artists of the day. I mean, Jacques-Louis David, who painted the amazing picture of him on horseback in the Alps, or Antoine-Jean Gros, who painted the incredible picture of him winning the Battle of Arcole, Ingres, who painted one of his coronation portraits. I mean, these are the great French painters of the day, and they are all hired by Napoleon and painting picture after picture of Napoleon. So it's really, he really did understand that. Now, as you say, eventually it sort of turned against him. There was a French phrase that became quite common by the end of his reign, which was mentir comme un bulletin, which is say to lie like a bulletin. So in other words, to lie like his military reports, because after a while, I mean, he would say, you know, we were sending back reports saying, yes, we've had great success in Russia. We have driven the Russians back and we haven't lost many men and the Russians are in complete confusion and we are just going to go to victory after victory. And by that point, everybody in France knew that this was complete crap. And they started to distrust his military bulletins, but it took a while. And it still had the effect. I mean, I think one of the most amazing effects of the propaganda you can see is the 100 days. I mean, he's able to come back to France after he's already been in exile and immediately rally a large part of the country to him. And that depended in part on his propaganda, his virtuosity in propaganda.
But would you say our continued fascination with him is due in part to his propaganda? I mean, you know what? The world has never forgotten Napoleon. They will never forget Napoleon because he just lit the imagination, I believe, of Europe, of so many people, affected so many people, probably in large part due to those paintings hanging in the Louvre.
Certainly didn't hurt. I mean, yeah. Think about it. I mean, we forget today not only, you know, did he have this incredible reputation at the time, but then throughout the entire 19th century, virtually every great writer was just obsessed with Napoleon. I mean, Balzac, Stendhal, Lord Byron, Nietzsche, Heine, Goethe, Hegel, you know, Lermontov, Pushkin, Tolstoy, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Walter Scott. I mean, they all wrote about Napoleon. Victor Hugo was completely obsessed by Napoleon. I mean, Victor Hugo's father was a Napoleonic general. Victor Hugo, had the Napoleonic Empire survived, Victor Hugo would have been a member of the Napoleonic nobility. He had once hated Napoleon and was absolutely fascinated and obsessed by Napoleon.
It's just incredible, incredible. Another thing about Napoleon that strikes me is that he was very much a family man. He kept his family around him, even though that they betrayed him in the end and they were not competent. And also, he kept his friends close. He had a core group of people that kind of went through him with his career. And I'm talking about Ney and Rapp and his generals. He was dedicated and loyal to them, even to the point where sometimes they weren't dedicated and loyal to him.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, obviously, there were just enormous ties of emotion and friendship and between these people. I mean, Marshal Ney, who turns against him after his first exile, but then comes back to him during the 100 days, and as a result is shot by the French government. I mean, his family, absolutely. I mean, it is, you know, it is a Corsican family. It is, you know, this is a, Corsica is a place of, you know, frankly, of clans and of intense family politics. I mean, And he relied on them. I mean, he relied on his brother Lucien a great deal. I mean, he couldn't have made the coup d'etat of the 18th of Brumaire without Lucien's help. Lucien became his interior minister in France. And then, of course, he put his brothers on thrones across Europe. Joseph was king of Naples and king of Spain. Louis was king of Holland. Jerome was king of Westphalia, and so on and so forth. So his sister, he married off his sisters, Caroline, to his comrade General Murat, who became king of Naples after Joseph. So yeah, it's all very much all in the family. And definitely the generals, the marshals are all this incredibly tight group who are bound together by this adventure and by his own force of personality. Absolutely.
What do you think was his military genius?
Well, I mean, his military genius was, you know, it goes back to almost his general genius. I mean, right? He did have these genuinely quite astonishing mental abilities. Above all, it was the ability really to hold in his mind at every moment, you know, the position of all the units, the strength of all the units, and to be able to see in his mind's eye how to actually maneuver these units to the best effect, and particularly how to bring them together with overwhelming force on the enemy's weak spot, which sounds obvious if you're not there, but if you're on the battlefield, and it's important also to remember the conditions of the, you know, the battlefields around 1800. I mean, they don't have telephones, obviously. They have riders who are going back and forth with messages. The riders don't always make it. Sometimes they get lost. People get lost a lot on the battlefield. Or they get shot. I mean, they get wounded. So you don't necessarily know the positions of all the units. I mean, you have tens of thousands, by the end, hundreds of thousands of people on these battlefields. The battlefields are huge. And, you know, often the weather is bad. There's fog. You can't see what's going on very well. Add to the fact that you do not have smokeless gunpowder at the time. Once the people start firing, once the cannon and the guns start firing, there are these huge clouds of greasy gray smoke, you know, everywhere. It gets very difficult to see everything. You know, the film, again, Ridley Scott's film, makes it seem fairly easy. He's there with his telescope looking on the battlefield. But in fact, he's relying mostly on reports from messengers. So he's dealing with very incomplete information. He has to make his best guess as to what is the accurate information and what is not. That's really important. He has to be able to figure out where the different units are, and again, how fast they can march, the conditions of the terrain, all of this, a huge amount to hold in his mind at the time. And, you know, he's able to do it for a very long time. I mean, interestingly, what happens, and one of the, you know, not only does he get older, and does he get more tired, and does he get, and gets more sick, so it's harder for him to actually simply, he's not as spry mentally as he had been. But even at that time, the battles are getting bigger. You know, the Battle of Leipzig in 1813 has 500,000 people, which is huge. It's five times what Marengo had in 1800. So it's all the more complicated, and it's all the more difficult to keep this all in his mind at a time when he is not as capable as he had been. But, you know, certainly at the beginning in Italy, whether at Rivoli or then later at Marengo or other, just, you know, absolutely amazing what he was capable of.
It is amazing because I'm a retired Army officer, and I look at his chain of command, and it really was him. It wasn't his generals acting independently. He was actually maneuvering those generals and those brigades. And it's amazing. And it's amazing, I mean, even with my military background, just to read about the Napoleonic War and to even imagine it in your brain as you're reading it one-dimensionally, to morph that into something three-dimensional. So how a human being did that and was able to maneuver these brigades and these battalions and these divisions, it's a special kind of genius. It really is.
It is. Fields, as the battlefields and the campaigns get bigger, he can't be as much in control anymore. And so, for example, in Russia, he gives a lot of responsibility to his brother Jerome, who just is not up to, who's not as smart as he is and can't do his
own. No, he's not. Yeah, yeah.
And that's one of the reasons they fail to catch the Russian army and defeat it decisively early on, which is what, of course, he was trying to do. I mean, he never wanted to conquer Russia. He just wanted to smash the Russian army and force the Tsar to make an advantageous peace. But in part because of Jerome's failures, not only, but as part of the story, he kept having to go deeper and deeper into Russia. Not a good idea.
No, it's not. I think that's gone over a couple times now in history.
Stay out of Sweden, Russia. Napoleon, Hitler, yeah.
I mean, yeah, stay out of Russia. Yeah. He not only is a great general, but he really does some things that transform Europe. His Napoleonic Code, his system of prefects and prefectures. What else do we have out there? He was successful on the civilian front, on the secular front, in ways that other emperors or other kings of Europe have not been. I mean, he was truly a transformative general, a transformative leader, a transformative government. And I studied Napoleonic Code. I'm a canon lawyer for the Roman Catholic Church. It is stylized under the Napoleonic Code. What, Italy, I think Spain, Belgium are still, France, still based.
Louisiana,
still based on Napoleonic Code, the style of it. What are some of his other great successes in Europe, do you think?
We should be careful. One thing about talking about his successes, one of the reasons he's able to do all this, of course, is he is a dictator, right?
I mean, he's an absolute ruler.
Yeah. He imposes massive censorship. He's not a Hitler. He doesn't kill massive numbers of political opponents. He's actually relatively gentle with most, although not all, of his political opponents. But he is a dictator. He doesn't brook any real opposition to his rule. He falsifies election results. The elections are rigged. They really are rigged for Napoleon Bonaparte.
Right. Okay.
So that's one of the reasons he's able to do this. And he's able to do that in turn with a great deal of popular support because, again, he's coming to power after the French Revolution when people are exhausted and divided and really feeling in danger and really want a figure who can bring them safety and security and prosperity back, and they've gotten tired of the politics and they just want somebody to take charge. And he does, but he does so as a dictator. He is very ruthless. One of the worst things he does is that in France's Caribbean colonies, you had hundreds of thousands of people of African descent who had revolted against, you know, the slave regime in the 1790s, who had actually managed to seize freedom for themselves. Then the French Revolution had granted them freedom, had abolished slavery. And then Napoleon brings slavery back where he can, which is a really bad thing to do.
Yeah, that was pretty bad.
So in Europe, he's able to make these reforms in part because of the absolute power he possesses like this. But what he does bring in, he brings in the principles of the French Revolution, not all of them, not liberty, but definitely civil equality and religious toleration. So that even though he brings back a concordat, which is to say a kind of treaty with the Catholic Church, he does not make Catholicism the only official religion in France, which it had been before the Revolution. He just recognizes it as the religion of most of the French. But he enforces religious toleration. This matters particularly in other parts of Europe that have not experienced the French Revolution, so that his men knock down the walls of ghettos, Jewish ghettos across Europe. They take away church lands and redistribute church lands across Europe. They strip the nobility of a lot of its privileges across Europe, and he brings in civil equality. Again, not democracy, not liberty, but he brings back a measure of sort of rational government, and particularly through the Napoleonic Code, which is a very streamlined, rational, sensible law code, and which is itself quite egalitarian in some ways. I mean, one of the striking things about the Napoleonic Code is that it enforces division of property among children. You can't simply give all your property to one child in order to keep the property together. You have to split it up among your children. You can't simply tell your younger sons, sorry, nothing for you, go off and do something else. Everybody has to get something. So that's part of the egalitarian principle of the Napoleonic Code. And this has enormous ramifications for all of European history. We forget just how crucially important he was for Germany. Germany had had the Holy Roman Empire. It was a kind of loose federation with certainly dozens, even hundreds of little statelets that had been part of it. And Napoleon actually abolishes the Holy Roman Empire. He forces a territorial consolidation of the German states. Even though he loses, the Holy Roman Empire never comes back. They bring back something called the German Confederation, the Deutsche Bund. And that makes possible German unification eventually. He also brings a great degree of unification towards Italy. We forget that Napoleon was not only emperor of France, but king of Italy, and ruled a united kingdom in the north of Italy. Italy under Napoleon, there was basically the kingdom of Italy under Napoleon, and then Naples, the kingdom of Naples in the south. And this was as close as Italy had gotten to unification. And again, it sets the stage for Italian unification in the 19th century. So these enormously important effects, thanks to his very disruptive rule.
Interesting. You know what I also find interesting? I mean, there's the Holy Roman Empire, there's the Confederation, there's
of the Rhine.
Fascination of trying to keep all these multiple states in Europe into some kind of form of unity. And that, I mean, it continues today with NATO and with the EU. And I wouldn't say he was the creator of it, but he was actually a precursor of it. And he understood the importance of unity, if anything, if just to glorify France. But he understood that these disparate states needed to be unified in some fashion. And I think that's a lot we inherit in part. I mean, they partitioned Poland. We never got Poland straight. The Congress of Vienna, 1815. I think you could actually argue that that was kind of a grounds for World War I and maybe even eventually World War II. So we kind of inherit a lot. I don't know. Am I right about that? I've always thought about
absolutely.
That.
I mean, he does create the Confederation of the Rhine. He creates the Duchy of Warsaw, which is the which revives a kind of quasi-independent Polish state after it had been partitioned and eliminated in the 18th century. We shouldn't forget that he expands France enormously so that France, in 1812, the borders of France include all of today's Belgium, Holland, Luxembourg, a great deal of northern and western Germany, parts of northern Italy, Catalonia in Spain, even parts of what are now Croatia, which are the Illyrian provinces. And so this is huge. He says to his police minister, Fouché, at one point, he says, I'm dreaming of a Europe where everybody speaks the same language and uses the same currency and the same weights and measures and obeys the same laws. And I think it's important also, that while he did expect that his empire would be centered on France, and while he expected that everybody would, that the language would be French, he did not insist that everybody speak French at home, or that everything had to be sort of turned into, that everybody had to be turned into French people. And in fact, by the end of his reign, one third of the French Senate was actually not French. I mean, there were Dutch, Belgian, German. And so, again, it was this principle of equality that when it came to actually running the empire, you would give opportunities to people from within the borders of France who were not subjugated. They had opportunities to participate in the life of the French Empire. Again, it's the principle of revolutionary equality at work. And so, yes, was this a precursor to the European Union? In some ways, yes. In some ways, certainly a more effective one, because the European Union has refused to produce, really to impose any kind of political unity on their member countries, which has been one of its big problems. You can't function as a unit without a degree of real political unity. But, Britain obviously didn't want that, so they got out, and other countries, have been hesitant as well.
What was his downfall? So 1809 was probably about his apogee, 1809, 1810, and then he kind of fell apart after that. What happened?
I would even say his apogee was a little earlier myself. I would say that the kind of continued expansion of the French Empire was not actually, in some ways, was not actually a sign of strength, but it was a sign of weakness, because he was forced to take over more and more places in order to try to close the continent off to Great Britain. And, it created these conditions of imperial overstretch. I would say his real high point was probably in 1807, when he's really able to dictate to the Tsar of Russia and the Emperor of Austria and the King of Prussia, what Europe is going to look like. But then by 1809, you have Wagram, you have a lot of other battles, which are not the great successes that his earlier battles had been. It's a question of size in a lot of ways. He can't control all the parts of Europe that he wants to control, and he can't control the battlefield as well as he had controlled his earlier battlefields. And he is getting older. He's getting tired. Everywhere in Europe, there are revolts against him. I mean, in Spain, Portugal, in Bavaria, in Italy. I mean, everywhere he is basically, it's like a game of whack-a-mole. He's trying to put out endless numbers of fires. His armies are getting stretched. The soldiers don't like being abroad for, not seeing their families for years on end. They don't like the fact that they're in hostile territory where, the peasantry are all against them and trying to kill them. And there's a dynamic where he can't not keep going forward. In order to beat the British, particularly, he has to keep expanding, and it leads him ultimately into Russia. It leads him into the disaster in Spain. Even with the disaster in Russia, even having lost maybe 400,000 men, he still, he has conscription. He's able to replenish his army. He is not able to so easily replenish his stock of materiel or horses, or for that matter, the experience of the soldiers.
Sure.
Ultimately, turns around, and as his enemies realize that he's weakening, they combine against him. The Prussians, who had been his allies, turn against him. The Austrians, who had been his allies, turn against him. And then he's driven back into France. He still fights brilliantly throughout the campaign in 1813, 1814, but it's not enough, and he loses.
Professor David Bell, this has been such an interesting conversation. I know you're a busy Princeton University professor and you've got things to do. I'm hoping that we can talk again about your book, Men on Horseback.
I would love to. This has been a great conversation.
Yeah, this is a great conversation and I can't wait to go see the movie. I hope my listeners go and see the movie and we hear comments about the movie and see what they think. But again, I really, really thank you for your time. It was such an honor to speak with you.
Well, it was a great pleasure to speak with you.
You've been listening to Crosswork, where cultural clues lead to the truth of the word. My name is Michelle Macklin, and we had the great opportunity to talk to Professor David A. Bell of Princeton University about Napoleon. I wish you a very good day. Thank you. God bless.